is Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's show, we're taking a bit of a trip back to the 80s, in tone and spirit at least, with The Expendables 3 and Let's Be Cops. We're going into the dystopian future with The Giver, and we're also going into sort of a weepy dramatic rom-com for the hipster crowd with What If, and going back 67 million years with Dinosaur 13. Before we get to those reviews, we're going to be talking about news in the box office and some trailer park. And there's also going to be the DVD Roundup, the world famous DVD Roundup. But before we get into all that, here's how to get a hold of us. If you want to reach me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or through Facebook at facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to find me on Twitter, go to twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. Let's move right into the news. A couple sad pieces of news. Of course, the biggest news in Hollywood and entertainment was the passing of Robin Williams. He had committed suicide at the age of 63, battling depression. His career was at times marred with substance abuse, although he was apparently sober at the time. And it's recently come out that he was in the early stages of Parkinson's, and that's a tough disease because there's no cure for that, and it's not a disease that kills you immediately. It takes years to do, and that was just another burden on him and another fear. He had been suffering from depression. If there's anything good that comes of this, it is shedding a light on depression and how it works, and that it is not just somebody moping around or being upset. It's a real medical condition. It's very sad for this to happen, especially him taking his own life. And we all have to think back to what he's going to be remembered for. And everybody has their favorite performance. The one thing that I think Robin Williams is going to be remembered for is for really changing the face of movies. People don't realize what a pioneer he was, because back in the 80s, when he was really taking off career-wise as an actor, you know, you either did comedy or drama. You did not do both. There was not a crossover. And Hollywood is very, very narrow-minded in that thinking, and they always have been. And he was a fantastic dramatic actor. He arguably a better dramatic actor than he was even a comedic actor, because he didn't rely on shtick to do his drama. And he started taking roles like in Good Morning Vietnam, where it had the comedy and it had very much of a Robin Williams thing to it, but it was an intensely dramatic movie at times. And then he did other movies later on, like Patch Adams and Good Will Hunting. I remember he took the role in Dead Again. It's a very small bit in Dead Again, Kenneth Branagh's film, and didn't want to be advertised in it because he didn't want people to think it was a comedy, because he was in it. So I think he really changed the face of casting at that point, and also helped by people like John Lithgow, who could go back and forth and do dramatic and then do TV shows like Third Rock from the Sun. So Robin Williams will be missed. Also, who died this week, Lauren Bacall, also passed away. She was much older. She was 89, and she died of a stroke or complications from a stroke. And that's sad, too, because she's a Hollywood legend. And so, you know, everything comes in threes. A lot of people are waiting for the third shoe to drop, I guess, in this celebrity trifecta of death. There was a death earlier, Menahem Golan, who is not nearly as famous as Robin Williams or Lauren Bacall, but he is this Israeli filmmaker who was famous in the 80s for importing, coming into America and making movies that are just really terrible. But I love them. Stuff like a lot of the Chuck Norris films and some of the Death Wish movies and a lot of these 80s action movies that dovetail into The Expendables. He produced a lot of these. And when I was in Jerusalem, I missed seeing The Go-Go Boys, which was a movie about him and his partner, Globus, the Golden Globus guys. And I feel terrible because he was there and had a chance to see him, but there was conflicting screenings. I never got a chance to see Go-Go Boys. So he will also be missed. It's been a rough week. In less depressing news, we can talk about Jason Momoa being confirmed as Aquaman, and they're fast-tracking that movie, and that's great. But I really want to point out the fact that I got a flame this week. Somebody sent me a note through my website that apparently, I didn't realize this, I ruined, quote-unquote, ruined Troll 2's perfect 0% score on Rotten Tomatoes. Apparently, it was a badge of honor that it's one of the few films that has a complete perfect 0%. And there is a certain group of people that are obsessed with Rotten Tomatoes score. I've been known for ruining 100% reviews before. Say Anything, which is a Cameron Crowe film from like 1989 or 1991. I reviewed it and I gave it a negative review and that busted its 100% rating. And people got really mad at me. People get take that so personally. And the point is, you only see these perfect ratings for films that only have a dozen or so reviews because you get enough reviewers and somebody's either going to like one that nobody else did and, or vice versa. Here's the thing with Troll 2. That was A, not intentional. B, I reviewed it years ago. It was just recently that I finally listed it on Rotten Tomatoes. I loved Troll 2 ever since it came out. I'm one of the few people who discovered Troll 2 before it was cool to know about Troll 2. I remember my sister and I were in a video store in the early 90s, about when it was released on VHS, and we rented it. And it was such a ridiculous movie and so crazy that we said, we love this because it's just so terrible. It's a terrible movie, but it's an amazing, terrible movie and entirely watchable from beginning to end. So that positive review I gave it is not some sort of trick to get me noticed on Rotten Tomatoes. I genuinely like the movie because it's this glorious disaster. Apparently, I am the bad guy in this situation. Final piece of news, Martin Lawrence announced that Bad Boys 3 is in fact happening. He announced this on Conan. I think it's hilarious that Martin Lawrence, who has the most to gain from this series and whose career is hitting the skids pretty heavily, is talking about confirming this movie. Apparently, Michael Bay isn't confirmed to direct, and he will potentially reteam with Will Smith. Well, how do you do a Bad Boys movie without Will Smith? If Will Smith's not involved, I can see you being involved without Michael Bay, even though a lot of people would say that for a Bad Boys movie, you need Will Smith and Michael Bay to come on board. I find this funny that Martin Lawrence is the one announcing it. It's sort of like the drummer of a defunct band announcing that they're all getting back together, but the lead singer, you don't know if he is. All right, that sound means that we are rolling into the trailer park. Real quick, a couple films I want to highlight this week. First one is Birdman, starring Michael Keaton as a down-and-out actor who had played a superhero, kind of mirroring real life.
We had it all. You were a movie star, remember?
Who was this guy? He used to be Birdman.
I like that poster.
You wrote this adaptation?
I did, yeah.
And you're directing and starring in your adaptation. That's ambitious.
Are you afraid people will say you're doing this play to battle the impression that you're a washed-up comic strip character?
This opens on October 17th. I don't know. I have real mixed feelings from this trailer because on one hand, I think it's an interesting approach of sort of the aging actor dealing with his superhero past, which of course Michael Keaton has. A lot of people forget that he played Batman in two films, 1989 and 1992. I mean, over 20 years ago. So it's been a while since Michael Keaton's put on any sort of cape and costume. But it looks like it's a bit of a convoluted mess. I don't know if this is going to be any good. That's the thing. It looks like an interesting concept, and it looks like it could be rife with comedy, but I don't know if it's going to be any good. Anyways, we'll see in October. The next film I want to highlight is The Second Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, which is a great title for a movie that didn't necessarily need to be made, opening March 6, 2015.
The Marigold Hotel has been going properly for 8 months now. People who come and go, but there's been a core of regulars from the beginning, and Sunny takes a roll call every morning.
A most valuable precaution to ensure that nobody has died in the night.
I thought the first Exotic Marigold Hotel was very charming. This one does seem to be a bit of an attempt to recreate Lightning in a Bottle, but you know, you put all these actors together and they're going to be charming. Even if it's not that great of a film, they're going to be charming. And of course, you've got Dev Patel playing the only characters that he can, racist Indian stereotypes, because he's like British. All right. Anyways, that might be fine. I find it interesting that it's opening in spring rather than it was a May film last time. I think it went up against the Avengers, and it did very well for what it was. All right, I've got to go to a break. When I come back, we're going to be talking about What If and Let's Be Cops. Fat Guys of the Movies coming at you with Kevin Carr at the helm, driving you into the great unknown or the great known. I mean, we know what movies we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about What If. That's the first one that's on the chopping block this week. What If is about a young man and a woman in Toronto who strike up an unlikely platonic friendship, even though they have feelings for each other.
I'm going to give you my number. We should hang out.
Yeah.
My boyfriend will be worried about what happened to me. So, friends?
Yeah, why not? Is this always how you make friends? Like it's a business deal?
Yeah, actually, It's just my style.
Okay, it's quite unnerving, but it's good. In fairy tales, love inspires you to be noble and courageous, but in real life, love is just an all-purpose excuse for selfish behavior.
I don't know if you are actually cynical or just a super crazy romantic cheese ball.
Probably the most notable part of this movie is it stars Daniel Radcliffe. And I find it interesting with his career that he's taken several years to try and do other films outside of Harry Potter. I mean, he had, what was it, Kill Your Darlings not too long ago where he played Allen Ginsberg. And this one, I mean, he didn't come out right out of the gate of Harry Potter doing other movies. He went into stage, which is an interesting concept. And he's also sort of built this real life persona. The fact that he went to Comic-Con this year and dressed up in a full Spider-Man outfit and just wandered around, I think is really kind of cool. I think it's interesting that he has a certain awareness of his fame and who he is. And that's great. I think that's a good thing because he could be pigeonholed as Harry Potter for the rest of his life. He may be, for all we know. He's a good actor. He totally is. And one of the best things he has going for himself is he doesn't quite look like Harry Potter. Maybe that's why he took a couple years off, was because if you watch this movie, it doesn't look like Harry Potter's in a romantic comedy. Because he's gotten a little bit older and he doesn't shave all the time. You know, he's just got sort of that 3-day growth. And I think he's doing it so people aren't saying, oh, Harry Potter, love story, which is good. I think that's good. Now, the movie itself, it's not my kind of movie. I'm just going to just go right out and say that. The reason it's not my kind of movie is it is what I like to refer to as a hipster rom-com. It is a independent rom-com. It's not your typical romantic comedy with, you know, that they made with Julia Roberts or Reese Witherspoon or Sandra Bullock back in the day. This is one of these movies that tackles what it's like to be real rom-com. And there's an awful lot of truth in this movie. I will give it that. It's based on a book, which of course I haven't read. Zoe Kazan plays the lead in it, the female lead, and she is not as charming as like Zooey Deschanel when it comes to the Manic Pixie Dream Girl character. And she struggles to not be that in this movie, but she ends up being the Manic Pixie Dream Girl because that's kind of who she is. She's got these ginormous eyes and she's very cute. She's not somebody you would describe as gorgeous, but she's still attractive in a cute sort of way. And I think she's having a harder time escaping the Manic Pixie Dream Girl image than Daniel Radcliffe is escaping the Harry Potter image. Now, when it comes to this film, what irritates me about this film is not necessarily something that the film itself is a problem. It's that the characters are so very realistic in a certain way because she just wants to be friends. She's already got a boyfriend and she's like, oh, let's be friends. And the thing is, I've freaking met girls like this. I dealt with girls like this when I was younger. And I find that to be one of the most offensively selfish attitudes for young women to have. Oh, I just like him as a friend. And flat out ignoring, not just not being aware of, but going out of their way to ignore the fact that guys who want to be friends want to be romantically involved. Let me just tell you, if you happen to be a young woman listening to this episode, you probably aren't because I don't think that's really my target market. But if you are listening to this episode, all guys want to have a romantic relationship. If a guy's being nice to you, they want to have a romantic relationship with you, especially if you're in your teens and your 20s. Do not be fooled by the nice guy. And I got caught up in that as well. There are girls that I knew in high school that they'd be the ones who call me when their boyfriend would break up with them or be a jerk. Girls like a certain kind of guy for a boyfriend, especially when they're younger. And when they get older, sometimes they can mature up a bit. But there's this misconception that girls are more mature because they like older men. Well, that's just as immature because you're liking a guy who is purposely liking somebody who is outside too young for him. Anyways, and girls don't want the friend. They want the boyfriend who turns them on sexually, but they don't want the friend. And that's the biggest problem I have. I could not get behind the character that Zoe Kazan plays because she is that shallowly whiny, I just want a friend who's really a boyfriend, but I don't want to mess that up. And Harry, when Harry Met Sally really tackled it very well, can men and women be friends? And kind of once that movie was made, it's kind of hard to not retread that or just be stupid and falling into stereotypes. So it was endlessly infuriating watching this movie because I knew people like that, and it bothers me those kind of people I think are shallow people and are not worthy of the affection that is thrust upon them. But there's so much truth to that. So it is real in that sense. And also, Zoe Kazan and Daniel Radcliffe have very good chemistry in this film, and it works out very nice to them. So I think it's going to work very well for its audience. If you like these sort of things, if you like the 500 Days of Summer kind of romantic comedy, you're going to love this movie. Me, I was kind of, so I'm going to give it a kind of rocks, simply for that reason, that I think it's going to do well with that crowd, and there's a certain truth to it, even though it wasn't exactly my cup of tea.
It kind of rocks.
All right, the next movie I got to talk about on Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr is Let's Be Cops. Jake Johnson and Damon Wayans Jr. play slackers in their 30s who pretend to be cops to get respect.
We're going to the costume party tonight.
Let's be cops.
Cops tip. Walk in the building, I own it.
People actually think we're cops.
I'm sorry, I had no idea that you were a cop.
She likes you, man.
You don't mess with the law.
Where'd you get this thing?
eBay, dude.
This is super illegal, right?
This? No.
No?
Wow.
This is an oddly timed release, and it could not have been predicted because of what's going on in Ferguson. Because who wants to be pretending to be a cop at this point, I guess? And people have pointed that out as saying, well, this is, it dovetails with this news story. And I mean, this isn't 9/11 we're dealing with here. We're not talking about releasing Donnie Darko the week after 9/11 and it involves a plane crashing into a building. This is just a stupid comment. This is a dumb movie. Don't get me wrong. This is an insanely dumb movie, but it's also very funny. It is extremely funny. Jake Johnson and Damon Wayans Jr. This one has them sort of being very accessible and revealing. David Wayans Jr. I like the fact that he's not just playing the super cool guy. I mean, he's a really good looking dude, but he is kind of the nerd in this movie. And Jake Johnson is playing a very typical Jake Johnson character, kind of this obnoxious, whatever, you know, kind of guy. He's the free spirit, the loose cannon, so to speak. Part of it is the two of them, they're clearly friends, and they have great chemistry. And this movie reminds me of the buddy films. Not the buddy cop films, although technically it's kind of a buddy sort of cop film. But I mean, stuff like when they had David Spade and Chris Farley pairing up in the 90s. There's a string of movies, and you always get that. You had Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, paired up for a ton of movies. But Let's Be Cops is extremely funny because it's just so stupid. It is the dumbest movie that I've seen in a long time, but it has some very funny moments, genuinely funny moments. It has no purpose whatsoever but to entertain and to make you laugh. And does it hold together? No. Is it? It's not exactly a well-written film, but it's funny. I just liked it that way. So I'm going to give Let's Be Cops a kind of rocks. It made me laugh.
It kind of rocks.
All right, that's it. I need to go to a break. When I come back, we're going to be talking about The Giver and The Expendables 3.
Shake that.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys of the Movies. We talked about the romantic comedy, and we talked about a regular straight-up comedy. Now let's get into the action and more sort of tentpole big event films. First one we're going to talk about is The Expendables 3. A team of mercenaries go up against a ruthless arms dealer who helped found their group.
We were close once. We started this whole Expendables thing together, but we had a falling out.
What are you gonna do?
Reload.
Hey, Barney. You should have killed me where you had the chance. You want them, kids? Come get them.
You were stupid enough to get yourself into this mess! We
party only once crazy enough to get you out of it.
I am a child of the 80s. I grew up in, I was a teenager in the mid to late 80s when people like Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Dolph Lundgren and the cast of the original Expendables, with the exception of Jason Statham and Jet Li and like Randy Couture, were the big guys were actually making movies. And these were the fun movies. These were the movies that were somewhat, they're disposable films. And that's what I like, those just sort of throwaway action films with Schwarzenegger and Stallone and even Dolph Lundgren. Red Scorpion's a great movie, by the way. If you've not seen it, Red Scorpion is a fantastic action kind of film. I have a great love for these old action movies and these old action heroes, these tough guys from the 80s. I thought the first Expendables was okay. I think Stallone wasn't the right guy to direct it because he tends to be a very heavy, dramatic director, whereas you just needed the fun, explosive directing, which you got with Simon West in the sequel. This one is cut from the same cloth. You get that throwback 80s action. But here's the thing with it. And I normally don't obsess about ratings because I generally think whatever the movie is fine. And I'm not one of those people who thinks that the PG-13 rating is the worst thing that has happened to in the history of cinema. You know, I'm not that person. But I will say at times, ratings do matter in terms of whether or not a movie's going to not necessarily be good, but to be what you want it to be. And The Expendables 3 is rated PG-13. Now, for the record, The Expendables 2 was meant to be PG-13, and then they decided to go R, and they threw in a lot of digital blood, which I think digital blood's worse than PG-13, because it looks terrible. So there was a certain degree of setup of the second movie that really felt PG-13-ish, but throwing in the blood made it grittier and more like an old action movie where they're having squibs. I just wish they had real squibs and real fake blood bursting out of people's chests instead of putting it in with a computer. This one, there's almost no blood whatsoever, and that's what makes it a PG-13. That's a big change that they did. You just don't have splatters of blood. So it gives it this sort of weird A-team quality to it, you know, where people are getting shot at and they just kind of fall down like a sack of potatoes, and there's no real consequence to that. I don't know if this is going to affect the box office simply because it was meant to be a PG-13 movie, and so you don't get the violence that you expect from these guys. Also, on top of it, while it's a fun movie to watch, it has this part in the middle where he kind of gets a new team. Stallone abandons his old team, which is like Lundgren and Jason Statham, and they go get Wesley Snipes and immediately abandon him. So he can get this new young team. But the thing is, this new young team, it's not the A-list actors. Because the thing is, if you had gotten like Stallone and Lundgren and Schwarzenegger and even Wesley Snipes at the time, if you were to get them in the late 80s, early 90s, the movie would have cost $500 million for everybody's salary. Now they can kind of get these guys for, you know, lunch and a box of cigars. And the young action stars aren't going to do the Expendables without $20 million up front. So, of course, their young people they're going for are people like Kellen Lutz from the Twilight movies. And sure, he's trying to be an action star, but he's not an action star. Let's face it, he is not the kind of guy that anybody is paying money to see a movie. And he's like the best of the bunch. They also go and they get this new Ultimate Fighter chick, and her name is Ronda Rousey. And she's attractive. She kind of looks like a butch version of Julia Stiles. And that's all fine and dandy. The problem is that she's terrible. I mean, she's attractive and she's fine to look at, but she can't even manage to say the one word lines. She sounds terrible. It's one thing to be in a movie and not be the best actor in the movie, but it's another thing to be in a movie and to be out acted, not just by Stallone and Lundgren and Schwarzenegger, but to be out acted by Randy Couture and Kellen Lutz. If you're the worst actor by far in the Expendables movies, you have a real problem. I mean, she's so bad, she makes Gina Carano from Fast and Furious 6 look like Helen Mirren. Because Gina Carano can really kind of hold her own. She's not a great actor by any stretch of the imagination. But this woman, Ronda Rousey, is horrible. I have not seen somebody who is so terrible at acting, even just by giving a reaction shot. I mean, we're talking like Rihanna in Battleship. I know I'm harping on this. The point is, in the middle, they don't need to get young people. Why are they bothering getting the young people? Because nobody cares. It's not like you have this staple of kids out there that are going to only see the movie if Kellen Lutz is in it. You can't afford the big names from today, so just stay with the big names from yesteryear. And that's where the movie works. So the beginning and ending works, the middle kind of falls apart. So in that sense, I'm going to say The Expendables, it still is a fun movie and it's worth checking out. I'm still going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's move on into The Giver. In a dystopian future, freedom of thought and life choices are suppressed until a boy chosen to be the keeper of humanity's memories decides to effect a change.
Who are you?
The Giver. When the elders need guidance, I provide wisdom using memories of the past.
Right.
You'll see them all in time, all colors, all differences. Our people chose to do away with emotions. Those morning injections take them away.
When people have the freedom to choose, they choose wrong.
Tomorrow morning, skip your injection. I've been doing it for months.
What do you feel?
He's not usually like this.
I'm surprised you're not more worried about him. I would be.
This is based on a book that's about 20 years old. And that's important to note because when you look at this movie, you start watching this film, you think it ripped off Divergent. But Divergent doesn't just rip off The Hunger Games. Divergent ripped off this book because this book's way older than Divergent. You know what I think the key difference is between like Divergent and The Hunger Games and something like this? The main character's a guy. The main character's a boy in this movie. And I think that's going to have a hard time connecting with an audience because the audience they intended. Not that it can't connect with an audience, but teenage girls are fickle and they don't want to see movies about guys. They want to see movies about girls who think they're have something super special in them that everybody sees, including these hot hunks that are way older than them. It's just ultimately what you get with especially Divergent and Twilight. So you don't have that weepiness, that mopiness, that teen angst. There's a little bit of it in this movie, but not to the level of Divergent. I think that's going to be its Achilles heel. That's why this movie's not going to do well. And I think you're going to have the same problem with The Maze Runner when it comes out next month. It doesn't pander to the right audience. And it in other ways, it works. The movie, it works better than Divergent. It fits together better than Divergent. It tells the story of this dystopian future and how everyone is rigidly put into this sort of caste system, but they're given the appearance of freedom of thought, but they really have none. The problem with this movie is it's really confusing at times. And I kind of had this problem with Divergent, but even more so with this one. It's like, how do they get to this point? How do they even affect this? They live on this plateau that's up in the air. And apparently past the plateau is the sort of like the wastelands. And if they go there, I guess they can go do things out there that would change things. And then this guy's a repository for memories. I don't know exactly how that works. It's kind of confusing. And why do they even keep that around? There's a whole bunch of unanswered questions in this movie that doesn't make a whole lot of sense that are maybe explained in the book, but not very effectively done in the film. It has some good acting in it. Meryl Streep's in it. She's fantastic. You got Jeff Bridges and he's good, except that sounds like he's got marbles in his mouth. Like he usually
talk like this in all the movies. This is how Jeff Bridges now delivers all his lines.
He sounds like a creepy sexual predator from a movie from the 80s in every movie he's done since like Crazy Heart. The Giver has some interesting things, but it is sort of this big bit of a misfire. And I don't think it doesn't make a whole lot of sense if you haven't read the books. Opinion. So I have to say that The Giver kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
I have to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking a little bit about Dinosaur 13 and then do the box office and the DVD roundup. Fat Guys at the Movies is winding down. Kevin Carr here with you for the last few precious minutes of the show. Let's finish up this show, though, and talk about Dinosaur 13. The amazing and frustrating true story of Sue, a near-complete T-Rex fossil that became embroiled in an unnecessary legal battle in the 1990s.
She's got two pieces of bone, only about this big. And I says, is there more of it? She said, there's a lot more.
And I looked at it, and I looked at him, I said, is that T-Rex? He said, yes. And I think it's all here.
I'm absolutely certain this is going to be the best thing we ever found, and it's going to be a complete T-Rex.
In your lifetime, you don't hope to find something that good, but we did.
It's a good American tale. Unfortunately, it had a bad ending for a couple real brilliant paleontologists.
I remember when this story was happening, because it was ironically around the time Jurassic Park came out in 93, and this whole thing started earlier than that. I remember when this was going on, and dinosaurs were at an all-time interest high at that point, and it was because of Jurassic Park, not just the book, but also the movie that was coming out. And it's a heartbreaking film because it was such an unnecessary event that happened. And if you don't know the history, basically what it is, a group of paleontologists out west found a near complete dinosaur skeleton. I mean, it's like something like 80% complete, which is rare. You almost don't find that. And it was this massive find, and they dug it up, and then there was suddenly a legal battle over who owned it because of these land issues. I'm not going to go into the details of that, but it's all covered in the film. And it also shows a certain oversweeping aspect of government. Government is there in terms of the authorities of government, the prosecutorial side of government is there to keep people safe and keep people doing the right thing and stop criminals. And this was an egregious example of government going after people who really weren't criminals at all and just making a huge mess of things. It's another great example of it's much more complicated than somebody calling the cops, but once you call the cops, it becomes complicated. It becomes a mess. And that's why a lot of times, you know, if you can solve a problem without calling the cops, you're usually better off, because then nobody wins. Especially if it's something that is unimportant, like a noise complaint in your neighborhood. The documentary is relatively well done. It does drag a bit at times, but, you know, it's a documentary. But it does a really fine job explaining where all the problems were in this battle for Sue and why it was such a mess and who the victims are. It definitely comes in as one-sided, because it's definitely on the side of the paleontologist. But I don't see how you can look at this entire situation and not be on the side of the paleontologist. I mean, sure, they probably didn't handle things properly the first time around, and they probably weren't as wise and savvy as they could have been. But, I mean, this was a pretty devastating thing that happened to them. And it really is a shame that certain people were able to basically get away with fraud and overreach of the government. So it is an interesting film, and it's worth seeing, because what it does, it shows whether you're a paleontologist or not, whatever you're doing, you might be doing little things that you don't think's a big deal, but if it then escalates somehow, you could be in big trouble for doing teeny little things that everybody seems to do. So Dinosaur 13 is a worthwhile movie to see. It's a good documentary. Check it out. It is playing in limited cities right now and on demand. Dinosaur 13 kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office really quick. Last week I said that Guardians of the Galaxy was going to win with $44 million. I was relatively close to the number. It came in with $42 million. So while my prediction for its box office was correct, I under-predicted what Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was going to make. That actually was surprising and also almost record-breaking itself, because it came in with $66 million, which, if you recall, when Guardians of the Galaxy came out, they were wondering whether it was going to break the $69 million record for an August release, and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles came pretty doggone close to that itself. This is a robust August compared to the last couple months, which had pretty big opening weekends and then pittered off after a while. Then Guardians of the Galaxy came in a second, and then Into the Storm, which was a terrible film, was at 17. That's about what people were expecting. 100-Foot Journey's like at 11. It underperformed what they were hoping. And then Step Up All In pretty much bombed with $6.5 million. The thing that's interesting, though, is there's been a lot of talk about what happened with the Turtles, because there's been a lot of people who say, well, it was just expertly marketed. And you know what? I am getting sick of people declaring a movie's success or demise is completely dependent on marketing. Marketing is involved. There is a part to it. But I've actually seen people say, well, it's common knowledge that how well a movie does on its first weekend is all about marketing, and subsequent weekends are all about how good the movie is. That's a load of BS. That is a load of honky-tonk badonkadonk right there. This is... This business is complex, and it's never a one thing or another thing. And the problem with statements like that is it's very hard to divorce yourself as somebody who handles film from what you think about a movie. Now, it's true. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles did kind of trample on the canon of the series, and it had some problems compared to the original. It wasn't like the original, and some of the diehard fans did not like it. However, people have been watching Ninja Turtles cartoons for 20-some years, and so those people still wanted to see the movie. And there's a group of people out there who seem to be so flummoxed by the fact that people would actually like this movie, the only explanation is, well, it's got to be marketing. It can't be that the movie found an audience. Whether or not you like a movie, I thought the Twilight movies were terrible, but they had an audience. I think that 50 Shades of Grey looks terrible, but it definitely has an audience. Just because I think it's not a good movie, I can't suddenly be like, well, they're just marketing it right. Because the reality is, it's usually a mixture of both. Guardians of the Galaxy did not make $90-some million last week simply because it was well marketed. And it helped that it fit in line with what Marvel was doing. It worked. It fit the mold. The only thing that marketing really does is if it gives people what they expect. And you know what's funny? They recently this week released the information for the Edge of Tomorrow DVD and Blu-ray. On the cover, it says Live, Die, Repeat. And then at the very bottom, it's like Edge of Tomorrow. People are saying, well, the big reason Edge of Tomorrow bombed was because it just was poorly marketed. I don't necessarily think that's the case. And people also complain that Edge of Tomorrow did not do well because they didn't retain the original title from the Magna, which was All You Need Is Kill. I will go to my grave saying, if it was named All You Need Is Kill, I don't think that was at all any better of a title than Edge of Tomorrow. Edge of Tomorrow seems very loose, could be anything. And at least All You Need Is Kill gives an idea of a violent movie. But All You Need Is Kill sounds like a gangster film. And it might work as a magnet, but I don't really see how that would have connected with an audience. The title of a movie doesn't always make that big of a difference. I think there were a couple things that caused Edge of Tomorrow to have problems. One of them was Tom Cruise is a creepy dude. And I think his time as being a guy who carries a movie are over. Because I've heard people say, I had my cousin came over and I was babysitting for her son. And she said, oh, is it any good? Because it's a Tom Cruise movie. And that's not to say that she has a brilliant opinion of movies. And I said that to somebody, like, well, that's just dumb. I'm like, well, that may be just dumb, but that is how some people think. Ultimately, it's intellectually dishonest to claim that marketing makes people see a movie that you personally don't like. It's appealing to an audience in some way, and that's fine. It's movies. So quit saying, oh, it's just because of marketing. Battleship wasn't marketed right in the U.S. No, Battleship was a stupid movie. And Transformers 4 is marketed just the same as the other three Transformers movies, and it's underperforming in the U.S. That does not mean that it's poorly marketed. It just, I think U.S. people in the U.S. are getting tired of that movie. Because you've had it four times already. Okay, rant's over. Box office prediction. I think Let's Be Cops actually has a chance of winning. I mean, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, it all depends on how well it holds. Since Let's Be Cops opened on Wednesday, went into the weekend matching TMNT's numbers. So maybe Let's Be Cops is going to do better. I don't think the Expendables is going to do as well. I think by the PG-13 rating and people get fatigued of sequels. And I think that one's going to suffer. All right, that sound means that we're leading into the world-famous DVD roundup. Really quick, we got to go through this. I spent a lot of time talking about dinosaurs and box office and marketing. Let's talk about the Muppets. Muppets Most Wanted is out on Blu-ray and DVD. This was a fun movie. Sadly, it did not do as well as the previous one. I welcomed them returning to making Muppet movies, and the Muppet movies are great. This one's clever and cute and adorable, and it has some fantastic cameos. It is everything you'd want in a Muppet movie. Go check it out. Rent it on Redbox. go buy a copy for the kids. It's great. That's one of the best ones out there. There's also Bears, which is a very charming Disney nature movie about Kodiak bears trying to live through the summer and get to the salmon spawning. Locke, which is Tom Hardy driving across England with his life falling apart, trying to keep it together on a cell phone. The stinker of the week is A Haunted House 2 because it's a terrible movie. And the first one was terrible, so just making fun of more bad movies doesn't make it any better. My time is up. I will talk to you all next week when we're going to be talking about Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, If I Stay, and When the Game Stands Tall.